This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. There are men and women who have put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom. And so often we don't understand what has been done in that regard and what some of the incredible stories right in our backyard might be. If you happen to hang around Cascade Manor in Eugene, Oregon, you might run into a guy who was somewhere pretty significant on December 7th, 1941. But he grew up in Southern California, and that's where we'll start with 93-year-old Sam Fryfield, an only child. You lost your mother when you were very young. How old were you?
Five
years old. That had to create some significant challenges growing up, but I get the picture. Just getting to know you here, you seem pretty resilient. I bet you got used to it pretty quick.
I seem to feel that way that I did, because I moved around every 2 years approximately until 1936, when I moved in with my dad there at Wilmington. And then after I left him, I went to the Navy.
Yeah, you went in the Navy, obviously, before Pearl Harbor. That's how you ended up there in December of 41. But you graduated from Banning High School. What was life like in Southern California? Because today you say Southern California, and people say, okay, it's Hollywood, it's the beach, it's, you know, there's so many stereotypes. But I have an idea that it might have been a little different back in the late 1930s. What do you remember?
I was standing on the corner of Avalon and Anaheim in Wilmington, California, selling the Los Angeles Herald Express.
Hey.
At a nickel copy, I got 2 cents of it.
Do you remember what your ambitions might have been at that age, what you were dreaming of doing?
Well, yes. I really intended to be an electrician, but I didn't manage to get on after I graduated from high school. After I got in the Navy, there was a possibility. The Navy had a program where if you made third class storekeeper or yeoman, and maybe some of the others, and if you passed the test, which was a very simple one really, you could transfer to electrician third class.
All right.
But I didn't qualify until January 1st of 42.
And some other things developed. Tell me why you joined the Navy in the first place, because, you know, they certainly weren't drafting anybody yet.
I knew that more was coming.
How'd you know?
I've been reading newspapers.
Well, if you were selling them, I guess you were reading them.
And I was reading the pertinent magazines describing what was going on. And also, I did have some contacts, Navy people there in Wilmington. So, as I say, I just knew it was coming. I felt I should get in before they passed the draft.
So you could decide where you wanted to go instead of them deciding for
well,
you?
Well, no, it's that I could decide whether I wanted the Army, the Navy, or Marines.
What
so
was it
I
about the
Navy?
Navy.
I liked the uniform a lot better.
All right, as simple as that. It wasn't the meals. It wasn't you wanted to get out on the sea. You just looked better.
Well, yes, I wanted to go to sea.
Well, the ladies did love those bell bottoms, from what I understand. So you joined the Navy. Did you ever get to a point where you regretted that decision?
No particular time. I might have had times when I felt trod upon, but in general, I got my paycheck, I got my food, I got liberty. I started on the USS Crosby, DD-164. DD means destroyer.
Yeah, tin can.
An old tin can whose hull laughingly was described as two coats of rust, two coats of paint, two coats of red lead.
So you didn't feel particularly secure on that ship?
I knew it was all right. It had been commissioned in 1921, I think, and then put in reserves there in the fleet there in San Diego. They recommissioned it in 39 sometime. I went aboard September of 40, but the Navy said, no, we're going to take a bunch of you guys off the Crosby and put you on other ships and turn the ship over to the reserves. So they took me off. I ended up on the Detroit. I eventually got into the pay office and stayed in the pay office as long as I was aboard her.
I haven't researched the Crosby. Do you know what happened to that destroyer in the war?
Yes, she was changed to an APD. That's a high-speed transport.
Uh-huh.
She served honorably through the rest of the war. She was involved in a lot of activity in taking small groups in and picking small groups up. But the Crosby, I think, survived. And the moment the war was over, really scrapped her.
As they did with quite a few ships. Mm. So you go from this destroyer to the Detroit, which was significantly bigger.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Was that an adjustment?
No. You're one of a large number of men. Mm-hmm. You go to the same place to eat. You might have different battle stations, but you're pretty insignificant in theory. En masse, you're very, very effective.
You said you wanted to get in the Navy. You were looking forward to getting out to sea. And I'm sure that being assigned to Hawaii, or at least being sent there, had to be a little exciting for a kid who grew up in Southern California, pretty tropical location. What kind of fun did you have out there?
Swimming. One of my places of enjoyment was a large theater out along Waikiki that had a large and beautiful organ. I don't know. I think it was on Sundays that they would have organ concerts.
Uh-huh.
And I, as much as I could, I went out there. I also did some sightseeing, more or less. In those days, they still were growing pineapple, a lot of it. Twice I can remember I went through pineapple growing and packing places. Somebody had the bus that went all the way around the island. I think it took us about 8 hours to
probably take longer now with all the traffic.
Well, no, it doesn't. No, I've been there. It doesn't take that long, but I can remember that that's one long ride and somewhat bumpy occasionally.
They didn't have the H1 all paved yet at that point.
I don't know what they had.
Well, and what I'm curious about, because we know now, you know, with the lens of history, we know what happened on December 7th. But did you guys have any inkling that things could be boiling, that the Japanese were poised to attack? Was there any suspicion at all?
I don't know what anybody else believed.
Right.
From my own observations, I could see that the war was coming, but I will not ever brag that I knew it was coming or anything. I agreed with the assessment of the big shots that it was going to be the Philippines. So when it did happen, I wasn't totally surprised.
Well, and it was the Philippines, too, pretty much simultaneously. But you didn't know it was coming to you there on Oahu. Yeah. So that Sunday morning, where were you? How did you realize that America was under attack? Walk me through those moments, if you can.
Well, I had slept late, and I was the last man in chow line. It was topside, and it was right up near the top of the ladder to go down to the mess hall. I heard an explosion, and I ran out to the rail. I looked aft, and the debris was still coming down. A torpedo had hit the Utah. Then I heard a plane. I looked out midships, and here was a plane dropping a torpedo in my lap. I don't know for sure what happened. In the book, it went aft. It went between us and the Raleigh, and went up on the shore. Somebody else said that it went underneath, but in the official war diary, it missed, went.
So when you say right in your lap, you're at the rail of the ship, and you see a plane heading right at your ship?
Yeah.
And it drops the torpedo into the water right in front of your ship?
Probably 200 or 300 yards out when we dropped it.
Wow. So then you're just waiting for something to happen.
Oh, no. One doesn't wait. One runs to a battle station.
Yes, sir.
Post haste.
And where was your battle station?
In way aft in the chief's quarters. And we handled the ammunition for the surface guns. We had 6-inch guns. Well, since we didn't use the 6-inch guns for the air attack, well, I think there were 10 or 12, I don't remember how many men, 10 or 12 of us sat down there for over 2 hours chewing our fingernails. We could hear distantly the big booms of the battleships getting hit, and also the hundreds of rounds of a 3-inch 50, we could hear that going off a huge amount.
But you guys needed to be there in case someone decided to use the big guns.
That was our battle station.
Right.
So yeah, when they said, load it up, well, we would have sent the rounds up to the turret.
And how did that work? How did you get them there?
There's an elevator, which was to prevent fires from reaching the magazine down below, and then to make sure that any explosion wasn't going to transfer from one end to the other.
Right. So that's where you were.
That's where I was.
For 2 hours.
For over 2 hours.
What was going through your head?
Well, I almost got shot.
How'd that happen?
I worked in a pay office.
Right.
And one of my senior petty officers was Chief Grignon. I was in the chief's quarters. And all of those who had been eating jumped up and went to their battle stations. So the tables had this food on them. I had not had a breakfast. So I was reaching for a slice of toast on one table. And Grignon, who, being the petty officer in charge of the group, told me to leave it alone. Put his hand on the 45. I went without breakfast.
I guess so. It would have been a real tragic story of the guy who died on December 7th because of a piece of toast.
Yes, that's one thing.
So when you finally emerged from there.
The first thing that they had us do, there were a large number of shell casings from the 3-inch 50 especially lying about on the deck. I and several others were put to work to throw them over. Then we were low on fuel. We had come in on Friday, low on fuel. We were planning to refuel. They said, no, come in tomorrow. But then they said, later on, they said, no, wait until Monday. So we were low on fuel. So now we were ordered, go over there and get some fuel. Then we headed out, going to the coast of the island to see if the Japanese were trying to land troops anyplace.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you something. When you mentioned being low on fuel, and you alluded to the torpedo earlier, and you said there are differing theories on what happened with it, but if it did indeed go under your ship, the fact that you were low on fuel may have saved you, right?
That was my usual statement until a few years ago, especially after reading this, I decided, no, it did go between us and the Raleigh.
And explain to us where you guys were positioned that morning, because I'm sure some people maybe have been to the Arizona Memorial and they've seen the diagrams, or maybe they've read some books about it, but there are a whole lot of ships in a whole lot of different places. Where was the Detroit when this happened?
We were moored at what's called Fox 13 along Ford Island, which is maybe a half mile from where Battleship Row was.
Right.
There's the Detroit. The Raleigh, another four-stack cruiser, was behind us, then the Utah and the Tangier. Now, this was normally a place where aircraft carrier would have been tied up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, aircraft carrier would draw more water than we would.
Absolutely.
So I, at one time, felt that both things, blow on fuel and being where a carrier would be, that pilot didn't know what he was doing. He saw a ship there where it was supposed to be a ship, and he dropped his torpedo, which was set to go low enough that it would get the carrier.
Right.
But it was too low to hit a light cruiser.
Especially one that was low on fuel and was sitting higher in the water.
Yeah.
So whether that happened or it went between you and the Raleigh, what you do know is the Raleigh was hit and the Utah was sunk.
Yeah.
So your ship was pretty fortunate to not be hit.
Yes, we were. Anyway, we left there, we fueled, then we headed out and went out looking, as I say, for the Japanese fleet or any activities. Didn't find it. Came back in. We were there for a couple of days, and then we took off convoy duty, headed for San Francisco.
Well, and there was probably a scramble to get you out of the harbor so you wouldn't be trapped in there.
That was one of the things. It's reported that we went out there in a hurry so that any subs firing would not get us.
Right.
Well, we didn't get hit, so I don't know if they had any.
And even though you're out there looking for possible Japanese forces, you didn't find any. And that's probably a good thing, too?
Yes. Because there was a heavy cruiser and a light cruiser and some destroyers.
So you wouldn't have been a very imposing collection of American forces if you ran into some serious Japanese ships. Oh, and while you were below deck, prepared to load that ammunition, you mentioned hearing the different things happening. And you heard the explosion that took down the Arizona?
Probably the Arizona. That one was a mighty one.
Mm-hmm. 2,400 Americans lost their lives that day, nearly half that number on the USS Arizona. The USS Detroit is the ship Sam Fryfield was on, and we have much more of his story to come when Hometown Heroes continues. I'm also very pleased to welcome a new affiliate station to the Hometown Heroes team from Sam's home state of Oregon. 1430 KYKN in Salem bills itself as the most listened to station between Portland and Sacramento, and we're very thrilled with the opportunity to bring this show to the audience there in Oregon and, of course, all the other stations airing Hometown Heroes. Big thanks to Program Director Gator Gaynor for jumping on board. And before we jump back into Sam's story, maybe you'd enjoy the one-minute video of him pointing out exactly where he was on December 7th, 1941. I have that up on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We'll be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.